House Energy and Environment Committee and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 838. And we have some panels that we're going to call up, and also I know folks are fighting over the sign-up sheet right now, so we'll wait while we call up some folks. Kat, can you give an overview of the bill, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 838 requires the Department of Energy to create a renewable portfolio standard under which electric utilities must derive 25% of annual retail electricity sales from renewable energy resources by the year 2025.
Okay, thank you. First, we're going to call up, provide an overview for the committee. Peter Cogswell from the Governor's Office and Mike Graney from the Department of Energy. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
For the record, please state your name.
Chair Dingfelder, for the record, my name is Peter Cogswell. I'm a senior policy advisor in the Governor's Office.
And Mike Graney, Director of the Department of Energy.
Yeah, hold on. We're going to close that door. There's a lot of rowdy people standing out there. Okay.
All right, Chair Dingfelder, I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I'm before the committee to express Governor Kuligowski's strong support for Senate Bill 838, the Oregon Renewable Energy Act, which would adopt renewable energy standards for electric utilities that supply power in Oregon. Senate Bill 838 is an important component of an energy package that the governor introduced so that Oregon appropriately supports and benefits from the shift away from traditional fossil fuel-based sources of energy to cleaner, renewable sources of energy over the next several years. The House of Representatives previously acted favorably on three other bills that are part of the package, House Bill 2210 relating to biofuels and House Bills 2211 and 2212, both of which expand energy-related tax credit programs. And we certainly hope that Senate Bill 838 ultimately enjoys the same success. Governor Kuligowski personally testified in support of a renewable energy standard earlier this session. He's not able to be here today, so I've submitted copies of his written testimony for the committee's review and consideration, and it's attached to the testimony that I'm submitting. I'm not going to read that testimony today, or his testimony, but I do want to note that it expresses his vision for making our state a national leader in fighting against climate change and promoting new domestic sources of renewable energy. The governor also summarizes the many ways a state like Oregon benefits from taking control of its own energy future. We have excellent energy potential in Oregon, renewable energy potential, and we need to be positioned to take full advantage of the transition to renewable energy resources and the demand for new clean power technologies. This week, the committee will learn much more about these two important points. It will hear from environmental groups that are excited about how shifting away from fossil fuel-based sources of electricity generation will protect or even improve Oregon's quality of life. We will hear from venture capitalists and developers who will discuss investment trends and the economic development opportunities for renewable energy and the importance of states to have policies like this in place to be competitive. They will learn directly from representatives of local governments, particularly those in rural Oregon, about how they expect their communities to benefit from this policy, both in terms of new jobs and new sources of revenue. Utilities, both privately owned and some that are publicly owned, will tell the committee that in its current form, the proposal provides them with the flexibility to meet the 25% by 2025 standard in a cost-effective manner. And representatives from some consumer groups and other energy advocates will indicate that over time, diversification of Oregon's energy supply with new state and regional sources of renewable power will result in many benefits for utility customers, including greater rate stability. Perhaps the most compelling thing about Senate Bill 838, however, at least to my mind, is how a diverse group of stakeholders, some of whom are frequently at odds with one another, work together to get the bill to the point where it is today. While it was sometimes contentious, and I suspect members of the coalition that supports this proposal had different motivations for getting involved initially, I believe the group was ultimately united by a common belief that we are best served by working constructively and collaboratively within the legislative process to develop this complex policy. I also can assure the committee that throughout Senate Bill 838's evolution, from the first meetings of the Renewable Energy Work Group to the numerous public hearings in the Senate, the coalition never lost sight of another mutually agreed upon outcome, that in developing a proposal that sets us on a course to accomplish the goals listed above, we do so in a manner that ensures Oregon remains cost competitive with other states. In Senate Bill 838, due to the hard work of the coalition and, to be fair, constructive comments from some parties that may still have concerns about the concept, the committee has before it a bill that positions Oregon to continue to be in its rightful place, at the forefront of the drive toward increased development and use of renewable resources in a cost-effective and responsible manner. I appreciate the committee's interest in this priority legislation for the governor, and I urge the committee to support Senate Bill 838. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think Mr. Graney is going to give a little more of an overview of.
And we have Senator Atkinson is in the back of the room, and I'm just wondering, Senator, would you like to come up and testify? Why don't you come on up, and then we'll go into the more detailed description from Mike Graney. Sorry, I didn't catch you sooner before I called these gentlemen up, so appreciate you being here.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you for allowing me to come in and go back out. For the record, I'm Senator Jason Atkinson, State Senator from Southern Oregon. There's a whole bunch of work that's been done in the Senate that's before you now that I hope your committee takes advantage of. There's several three main components to the bill that we actually worked in this work group that I'm very proud of. One of which is changing the percentage amount, which I'm sure you're going to hear quite a bit about, regarding Eastern Oregon. I work very closely with Oregon Trail Electric and several others, and negotiated very closely with Senator Vakian and the governor's office, and we came to a good bill. Second part of it that I hope that you really investigate further is the R&D funds that are used, that can be used in addition to investments that are made. And I think as you look at Oregon State University and wave technology, those R&D provisions that were written in this bill, I think, are really good pieces of legislation. Thirdly, and I'm sure you'll hear from this also from the experts, but there was some provisions that we wrote in for one of the IOUs, one of the for PacifiCorp owned utilities. And I think that, through a tremendous amount of work, also creates a good bipartisan bill. Now, bipartisan, as I said on the floor when I co-carried the bill, is in the eye of the beholder. But I was certainly glad to add to it. But there's two main things that when my closing speech was done that I did not get to make. So I'm here, Madam Chair, to make those now for the record. I talked quite at length about how what this bill really does is a market maker for a bill that will be out of date within a few years. In fact, I think that this legislation, as I said on the floor, as I believe now, especially as an avid reader of Wall Street Journal and The Economist, I think as soon as we pass this bill, the time starts to tick, and this bill will be out of date in two to perhaps three sessions. The reason is that as we set Oregon on its foundation of this type of energy and this type of renewable, the technology and the market will move much faster than our ability to legislate. We have the belief in this building that we are number one as it comes to renewable energy, and actually we are not. This bill would move us closer, if not in the lead, but right now, believe it or not, we are behind the state of Texas. Texas, with a same political persuasion as I, leading their governor and their legislature, put in place an RPS bill that has had them take the lead from California as it comes to wind energy. Our provisions are a little bit different because we have wind, we have solar, we have wave. And as you have experienced even far more in depth in your committee, as you kicked it over to us, is biofuels and ethanol. But this real bill is helps us get started and then helps us lead. It also does something that I think is very interesting from a business perspective is that this says to the venture capital world, please write big checks in our state. And as we saw from the new energy siting law that then-Senator Beyer and I worked on in 2001, when we changed up and streamlined the new siting laws for new power production facilities to come online, in came money. And that is what we also hope to do on this particular legislation. Now, the two points that I made that I didn't get to make. First point was this. There's a friend of mine who's in this business in Missouri. And through working with local communities and agriculture and a grid, they were able to put in some wind. It was wind that they chose to invest in northern Missouri. This community had not been invested in by the state, let alone the federal government, in about 80 years. And now it's got wind towers on it. The funny thing about the wind towers is that the Chamber of Commerce decided to make them, since they're so unusual, a tourist destination. And the community is now marketing itself as completely off the foreign oil. Now, if that's a stretch, I did talk to the Missouri Secretary of State, and we winked and laughed about that. But, hey, it was an investment that was made into rural Missouri that had been left out of the significant changes in the economy in the rest of the state. And I think we also make the case for that as we look at Union, Gillum, Grant, Sherman. Did I say Union? There's some people behind me in Union. I want to say Union County twice. I think that's important. So anyway, I'm excited about what this bill could be, and I'm excited to work on a piece of legislation that will be outdated. But what we are doing is we're setting a tone for a market to come in and to drive and to actually outdate this piece of legislation. So I'm excited, and thank you very much for your deference, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator. We really appreciate you taking the time to come here. Are there any questions, quick questions for the Senator before we release him?
Okay. Obviously not.
I just accused somebody of doing that last week, so it's my chance to do it myself.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm released now?
You're released. You can go back to your side. You are on your side.
Actually. I am, Madam Chair. We're renting. No, just kidding. Okay.
And thank you for your comments. Much appreciated. Mr. Graney, hard act to follow.
Definitely. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mike Graney from Department of Energy. For the reasons that both Peter Cogswell and Senator Atkinson mentioned, this is a very important bill. It's also a bill that, from an energy point of view, we think is very workable. The bill underwent many changes in the Senate in the course of work on the bill to make it flexible, to make it Oregon-specific, and to be able to work for Oregon's utilities as well as for the renewable energy industry. The bill does require that 25% of each of the utilities that are covered by the bill, that their load be met by new renewable energy by the year 2025. That threshold, as Senator Atkinson mentioned, is 1.5%. Utilities who serve 1.5% or more of the state. And I provided a chart that lists the utilities and their respective load, so you can see where that threshold is. It covers Oregon's three investor-owned utilities, electric utilities, as well as six of the larger consumer-owned utilities. The other consumer-owned utilities that fall below that 1.5% line meet a lower standard, only 5% of their load from new renewable energy by the year 2025, to give them added flexibility. The definition of renewable energy is very broad, including sources, traditional sources, and also including new hydro and efficiency improvements to existing hydro. A number of provisions were added to assure that utilities and their customers are not penalized because of this standard. For example, there's a requirement that utility must not give up access to BPA power in order to meet the standard. Let's not give up access to the Mid-Columbia dams that provide inexpensive hydro for a number of our utilities. The utility is not required to shut down any existing resources in order to meet the standard. The focus, again, is on new renewable energy, and we think that the standard will result in most, if not all, of Oregon's load growth being met by new renewable energy, depending on the rate of load growth of the individual utilities. So again, the focus is on the future, not the past. While we think that in the long term that the renewable energy standard will result in lower rates than by continuing to rely on increasingly costly fossil fuels. The bill has a cost cap to assure that, to set a limit on what utilities exposure would be in compliance with the standard. And if that cost cap is exceeded, then the standard does not need to be met in those years when that cost cap would be breached. The bill has a number of other important provisions. For example, it extends the public purpose charge through the year 2025 to match the renewable energy standard, and the renewable energy portion of the public purpose charge is devoted to small renewable energy sources of 20 megawatts or less. There are a number of options for utilities to comply with the standard, including owning their own resources, purchasing power from specific resources, or buying what are called tradable renewable energy certificates. And there's detailed provisions on those. Provided a second handout for the committee that gives an overview of the bill and then a detailed section-by-section summary. And I'd be happy to, after the committee members get a chance to look at that, come back and answer any questions if you have on that. But in summary, we think this is a good bill. It's gone through a lot of work. The regulatory structure that the PUC has is maintained for investor-owned utilities, and the consumer-owned utilities, the various requirements are, they maintain their own internal regulatory structure by their boards. There's no change in regulatory structure over the consumer-owned utilities as well.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Greeny? I don't know if you, I'm not going to have you walk us through section by section because it's a, it will take up a lot of time. We have a lot of people here today, but I do encourage you, if you have specific questions, to ask Mr. Greeny to come and sit with you and walk you through the bill. But Representative Smith?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is actually from Mr. Cogswell. It's good having you here.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
In Section 4, it talks about the definition or types of energy that can be used to comply with renewable portfolio standard. What was the rationale for leaving out hydro dams?
Well, I think that the rationale was how to strike the Chair Dingfelder, Representative Smith. I think the goal in developing this policy was how to achieve the goals that we want to accomplish without disadvantaging, you know, existing resources like hydro. And what we were concerned about is if you just count all existing hydro towards the standard, what's been great for the state historically, the conversation is about where do we want to go with, you know, in the future as we go out and utilities are going out to acquire new resources to meet their energy load. And so the conversation focused on, if that's the case, then how do we want to accommodate hydro? So we recognize in the bill that hydro is a renewable resource, and then we define in the bill the different ways that it counts towards the standard. And I think that the main thing that we did while counting, you know, new hydro or low impact hydro to a certain degree and efficiency upgrades at existing hydro facilities, so we also put the protections in the bill that that Mike mentioned, that consumer-owned utilities that get power power from the Bonneville Power Administration don't need to shift aside that power to comply with the Act.
One last question, and this is actually a question for Mr. Greeny. Mr. Greeny, can you share with the committee your understanding of the capacity of the hydro dams on the river? And perhaps that's an area of expertise you don't have. I'm just curious, are they running at 100% capacity? They run at 50%? Production capacity?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, offhand, I couldn't tell you. It does vary a lot based on, of course, the volume of the water. This has been a good hydro year compared to the last few years. So the hydro system is from Bonneville for the entire region is currently providing over 10,000 megawatts of electricity.
Just a quick follow-up.
Thank
you. Do we know if that means that the dams are running at capacity and that they're not able to generate additional electricity?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I would have to get back to you on that. I don't know offhand, and it varies probably by dam.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Jensen and Representative Burley has questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In relationship to the small utilities, small electric utilities, you exempt out first, parts of the bill those with equal less than 1.5% of all electricity sold to, et cetera. Why was 1.5% chosen as a number there? What was the rationale or reasoning?
Chair Dingfelder, Representative Jensen, we started actually at 1%, and the idea being that we want to have that there was a line above which that for the smaller utilities that it made sense to have them not complying with the larger standard, but for the larger utilities, we wanted to have the maximum amount of utilities and doing their part to help us achieve these goals, and that 1% was originally derived at by the Renewable Energy Work Group. Then in the process of working through the Senate, and this gets to what Senator Atkinson was getting at, concluded that in fact there were some compelling reasons, namely the situation involving Oregon Trail Electric, to raise that threshold to 1.5%. But we aren't comfortable going up to the 3% or letting out everyone, because we're trying to get some utilities in the bill that are the larger consumer-owned utilities, and they are growing and are out looking for existing resources, and we want renewable energy to be part of their thought process and ensure that they're doing their part, just like the customers of investor-owned utilities are going to be doing under the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
In Section 3 or Sub 3 of Section 7, can you explain that to me? The exemption provided by one of this subsection terminates if an electric utility... etc. acquires electricity from an electric generating facility that uses coal.
Right. Again, and that provision is in there to apply for those utilities that are in the 5% as of 2025 standard. Is that we didn't want them to be in a position where they went out and acquired resources that were contradictory to the goals that we're trying to achieve by enacting these renewable energy standards. So they aren't required to comply with the 25% by 2025 standard. But at the same time, we didn't want them to go out and acquire a new coal resource or something like that. So the goal here is just to...
Clarification.
I'm sorry.
So anyone, buying from the PGE plant in out of Boardman?
Well, Chair Dingfelder, Representative Jensen, we do protect in the bill existing ownership contracts, so this is only new investments in coal resources and kind of ownership or long-term contracts are what we're getting at. The language that's in that section is to clarify that existing ownership interests, or if BPA offers a product that contains a little bit of coal, but that does not trigger that provision. It's only the owner direct investment in ownership or a long-term purchase agreement from a new purchase agreement from a coal facility.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Representative Burley. Well,
thank you, Madam Chair. And Peter and Mike, both of you, thank you very much for being here today. A lot of what's been said here is introductory, including Senator Atkinson's comments. I don't think anybody at this dais, but I don't want to speak for my colleagues, would disagree with necessarily. There are two philosophical differences on how we try to move forward on this issue. One is through tax credits, the incentive, or the hard mandates, which is what this is. And I don't think it's any secret that my principal concern here is the rate shock to the ratepayers. Now, I'm very glad to see that Central Electric, which is my co-op, is beneath the 1.5% threshold, but my guess is, given the growth in Central Oregon now, won't last very long, so they will be a large. And the other half of my house district is already served by an IOU, so my ratepayers will definitely be impacted by this. And one of the things that, as I've read this bill through in painstaking detail, and Madam Chair, I'm not sure how you want to proceed, because I've got pages of questions I could go through in absolute excruciating detail with these folks, or anybody else for that matter, but I still, even have, after having met with one of the utilities and some other folks on this, I just am not yet convinced that we're not going to see some rate impacts. In fact, anybody that tells me it's not significant, then I ask the question, why do we have a rate cap? Why do we have an alternative compliance payment? And well, I'll stop with that, but I've got some more questions I'd like to follow up with. Thank you.
And just as about your question, my suggestion would be to sit down with either of these two gentlemen to start with, if you have specific line by line, because we won't have time today. I have a whole group of people from Eastern Oregon that I would want to make sure that we do get up here to testify, since they've come from very far away. But my suggestion is that, and I'm sure that both either of these gentlemen would be happy to sit down with you to make sure that your questions get answered. But if there's some other broader questions that you want to bring up for them right now, otherwise we have a lot of people from Eastern Oregon. I want to make sure that they get a chance to testify.
Okay. Thank you.
We'll be happy to do that, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other? You want to do another question?
If I could, let me just get one of them out here at this point. The qualifying facilities in Section 3, starting on page 2, talks about if the facility is operational on or after January 1, 1995. What's the significance of that date?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, the reason for that, the initial recommendations from the Renewable Energy Working Group was 1998 to pick up the sort of the new generation of wind farms that have come on in Oregon. We thought that they're recent enough that the state should take credit for it and the utilities should receive credit in the renewable energy standard. The date was moved back further because during that intervening time between 1995 and 1998, a number of wood-fired biomass facilities had also come online, newer technologies that there was support for, as this bill was being discussed in the Senate, broader support for including those facilities as well. And that's the reason for that date.
Quick follow-up? Thank you. In the biomass, which also, as I'm sure you're aware, is my area of particular interest, we do have some pioneering individuals in this state that actually had biomass plants online as much as 30 years ago, give or take. Yet they wouldn't get credit under this January 1, 1995 date. What would you feel about amending this and moving that back to capture some of those facilities that are online and have been upgraded over time, so that we're not penalizing those individuals and recognizing the fact that they are producing renewable energy and have been for almost three decades?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, to the extent that they make efficiency improvements since 1995, those will fully count for the RPS. I think our concern about going back further would be, again, the issue of including the large hydroelectric facilities, and that really we'd have to recalculate the entire renewable portfolio standard. Plus, there's a great variation utility by utility on who has access to those hydroelectric facilities.
And then one last question. Mm-hmm. I promise I won't ask this panel anymore. The other major problem I have is, you know, we've got between the consumer-owned utilities and the investor-owned utilities, we have two entirely different business models. One is operating on a for-profit basis for their investors and shareholders, and the other one is operating on a least cost for their consumers. And I'm having a great deal of difficulty trying to come to grips with the fact that we're trying to hold both of these business models to the same standard. And I think for the consumers of the COUs, that creates a disproportionate hardship. How do you respond to that?
Chair Dingfelder, Representative Burley, I think that it's, to my mind, it's not as much an issue of holding them to the same standard, because I think that, I don't like distinguishing based on the nature of the utility that serves the customer. I think it's incumbent upon us to recognize the differences of these different forms of utilities and ensure that we craft a policy that recognizes and is fair and balanced to the customers of investor-owned utilities based on their structure, as well as recognize the structure of consumer-owned utilities and recognizes their unique needs. And I think you'll see in the bill that there are provisions in the bill that that give the consumer-owned utilities greater flexibility to comply. For example, using 50% renewable energy credits through 2020, research and development language and the alternative compliance payment provisions of the bill, to name two. But that's what we've strived for, is recognizing that, they can still go or try to achieve the same standard, but they might have different processes and needs to be able to get there. And I think that's what we've achieved.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for the panel?
I just have one comment, Madam Chair.
Quickly, because we have folks from your county that are here to testify, and we want to make sure that we get them in.
It's very good seeing you here. And this is a comment for Mr. Cogswell. In my view, Senate Bill 838 is a solid piece of legislation. It's good legislation, with a couple exceptions. And as we're in a public hearing here, I just want to share my thoughts with you. I'm concerned about the impact this is going to have on several of the electric utility cooperatives. And to me, in my four terms in this building, I've always found that the best legislation is legislation that comes from compromise. And I would hope that over the coming days or coming weeks that you would continue to sit down with the electric cooperatives to try and find a compromise that would work for the governor's office and would also work for the House, so that way a majority of members in this House can come along on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate you coming here today, and I hear we'll be talking to you a lot.
We'll be around.
Thanks very much.
Week or so. Okay, next, we do have several folks that came from out of town, so I want to make sure that we get them up here before we run out of time. First, we have Gary Thompson from Sherman County, Boyd Rasmussen, Union County, and then we also have, I can read this, Ormond Hildebrand from Wasco County.
Wasco.
Oh, I down Wasco. Okay, you can all come up, please. There's three seats and two microphones, so you can share.
I don't.
You can help mediate this forum if you'd like. Thank you for coming here. Appreciate it. We know you came a long way. Appreciate hearing your comments. And for the record, please make sure and state your name.
Hildebrand is my name. My first name is Ormond. Madam Chairman, thank you very much. Let me just first say that our family has been trying to farm in the Sherman County area for the last 100-some years in dry land wheat operation there in the north central of Oregon area between the Deschutes and the John Day Rivers area. We are in the middle of some of the larger wind farm developments right now with Klondike 1, Klondike 2, and Klondike 3, along with the Portland General Electric Bigelow Canyon. We have seen the potential for trying to develop our own small, local-invested wind farm for the area. And we believe that, as this bill points out and tries to encourage small, local-owned facilities are 20 megawatts or less, this is very important to us. The bill is well-crafted. We think there's substantial protection for the consumers and the consumer-owned utilities. We are also long-term members of the Wasco Electric Cooperative. We've worked very closely with them in our project. Our family feels very strongly in support of this bill, and we would ask you to support this also as the committee. That's our statement. Thank you.
Thank you, and appreciate you coming here today. Sheriff?
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder. Sheriff Rasmussen, Boyd Rasmussen from Union County. Appreciate giving me the opportunity to visit briefly with you. As all of you are aware, we're losing our timber tax receipts. If not this year, it will be in 5 years. Even without this loss, my office is still facing possible cuts to equipment requests, which may literally jeopardize the safety of the people of Union County. Our forests are being locked up. We have lost and are losing family wage jobs because of it. We have another natural resource that is locked up, and that is wind. The passage of this bill will encourage the harvesting of this great natural resource and will bring millions of dollars in new investment to my county and others as well. We'll replace the lost revenue from timber tax receipts. This bill is more than just a renewable energy bill. It is also a bill about using natural resources wisely. It is about new jobs. It is also about providing new revenue to my county and allowing me and my office to provide adequate protection for the citizens of Union County. We currently are not a 24/7 office, which means there are large gaps of coverage in our county where a citizen will call 911 and there's nobody to respond, not a deputy, not a state trooper. This legislation is crucial for us to maintain the coverage we have and to push for 24/7 coverage in Union County. This bill is good for all of Oregon. I sincerely appreciate the leadership from Republican Senator Jason Atkinson, who enthusiastically endorses this bill in its current form. Senator Atkinson knows the needs of law enforcement and how this bill will directly help law enforcement in Union County and other counties also. Additionally, this should be a bipartisan bill. New Hampshire's House voted by a margin of 253-37 to adopt House Bill 873. This bill is similar to ours and requires 25% of the energy to come from renewables by the year 2025. I believe that Oregon should do the same. I urge and encourage this committee to support this current bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Judge Johnson, thank you for coming today. Appreciate it.
Chairman Dingenfelder. Represent the Burley and the rest of the commissioners or representatives. These fellows basically stole my thunder. They said everything that I was going to say. With one exception, this bill also leaves space. There's mention in this bill of small community projects. We've experienced over the last 3 years, 4 years, of trying to get a small community project up and running. We have had a very hard time being able to get interconnection. We've had a hard time getting power purchase agreement. With this bill, I think it sort of forces the utilities to accept our power that we can produce, and now we should be able to go on and build our small community projects. Secondly, I firmly believe that this wind power is actually cheaper than coal and will help keep the power rates down when the utilities transfer over their extra power having to come from coal-fired plants. I'm a firm believer that it is actually cheaper because once the facility is built, there is no input as far as price of the fuel. So you've got to take that also into consideration. A coal-fired plant that's old and dirty and carbon flying out of the smokestacks, or the new facilities that are not yet built, not yet proven, and not even sure if they can do what they say they can do. Plus, having to import the electricity from Utah or Montana. I think we need to generate our own electricity and sell it that direction, opposed to them selling it our direction. That's all I have today.
Thank
if there's
you.
Anything else, let me know.
Any questions for the panel?
Just very quickly, I just want to thank all three of you for coming, and Judge Thompson, it's good to see you again, and thanks for coming. I appreciate your comments. And this is your comments about the troubles that you've experienced in getting sale contracts and interconnection is something I'd like to hopefully over the course of the next few hours today and on Wednesday hear more about, probably from the utility companies, because you know, I've heard this time and again, and this is why some people say we need to have an RPS, but that's also why I say I'm a little bit concerned about the cost, because I suspect, and I may be proven wrong, that the difficulty you're having is because of the economy of scale of these small community-based projects causes the unit cost of production for your power and interconnection and all the other associated costs that you're not competitive at the market rate. Now, again, I invite somebody to show me that I'm wrong, but that's my suspicion at this point in time, and that's part of why I'm a little bit concerned about the impact to the ratepayers and how much is this really going to cost us to do this. What I'd like to do is, through the Betsy and other bills that we have passed, is help drive that cost of production down through tax credits and other means so that it can be competitive at the market rates.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments?
Good seeing you, Sheriff.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Chair. Representative Burley. I believe I have a meeting with you tomorrow, and I will bring an explanation to you tomorrow.
I look forward to it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen, for coming all the way here. Appreciate your testimony and input today. We have some other folks also from over 100 miles, and Don Coates, Gary Thompson, and Don Coates, Marty Myers is with Three Mile Canyon. I know came from far away, and John Lomero. Sorry if I'm saying that wrong.
You said it correctly.
Thank you, gentlemen. Let me go ahead and start.
Okay. Thank you, madam. I appreciate the opportunity to speak before you today. I'm a fourth-generation wheat grower from Sherman County. I actually live in the Dalles.
Please state your name for the record also.
Don Coates. I'm a past president of the Oregon Wheat Growers League. I've also been the president of Mid-Columbia Producers, which is a large co-op there in Sherman County. I'm currently serving as executive director, executive on the executive board of Community Renewable Association. I've been involved for about 4 years in attempting to put together a couple of different community-owned wind farms. One of them is about a $3.5 million project in Sherman County that would be a single turbine project and involve the ownership of two farm families. And the other project is about a $17 million project that would involve four farm families in ownership. going back to some of the comments were made earlier about difficulties in marketing and interconnection, I have some personal experience in those endeavors, and it's difficult, and it won't happen without policy. And utilities are notorious for not wanting to accommodate small generators. It's runs across the nation. It doesn't matter where you go. It's a common theme, and without policy to support it, small generators are not going to have access to the markets, and interconnection is just a means for utilities to make it difficult. We've made a lot of headway here in this state in the last few years, and this bill will go further to make those policies work for these smaller projects. As far as the efficiency of the smaller projects, I think Representative Burley's comments are very rational thought, but I think that there are some distinct advantages to these smaller projects that can lend themselves to the development of the economies of a lot of rural areas in our state. There's a lot of places where you can plug in a smaller generation source where you can't even think about plugging in a large generation source. Those advantages are there for the taking if we have some policy to support them. And this isn't just wind. We're talking about small hydro, wind, your biomass plants, geothermal, the wave energy. All of them are geared towards smaller generation sources that need policy in order to market them and interconnect them. And this bill encourages it, and it doesn't spell out exactly how it's going to happen, but it very clearly states that it's important to make the small projects part of our mix. And I think it's something that can go a long ways to improve the economy of rural Oregon. Got off my notes. Some of the opposition to the bill that I've been aware of is around the price concerns. And, you know, there's really not a lot to base that on other than a fear. And if you go to study the other states that have already enacted similar legislation, there's not one state out of 21 states that have similar legislation that have any report of significant rate increases. In fact, the studies indicate that the average rate increase is something less than 1%. And I guess my feeling is that the rate cap does protect us in the unforeseen circumstance that renewables become out of line with the rest of the opportunities for power generation. Another issue that opponents often talk about is the loss of local control. And I guess just considering what's going on in Washington right now, I'd just about be willing to bet my ranch that we're going to have a some sort of climate legislation within the next year. I don't think it's going to be a utility's decision whether or not to buy carbon-based power in the near future. And this legislation is a proactive thing. It encourages the utilities in our state to get involved in renewables, and I think it's the right thing to do, and I think it'll benefit our state, and I strongly encourage you to support it. And I thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you very much for coming here today. Mm-hmm. Appreciate it.
Madam Chair, my name is John Lamoureux. I'm a former county commissioner from Union County, and I appreciate being before the committee today, and especially Greg Smith, who has served us so well in our district and as a good friend and an honored friend. I am kind of a strange bird, or people have often call me that when they see my car. I have I support wind energy sticker alongside I'm a life member of the NRA. And some people have mentioned those don't seem to go together, and I tell them, well, you better start noticing them because they're going together more and more. But I am conservative, and I support this bill 100%. I am in Union County. OTEC has been written out of it. There was a collective sigh of disappointment in Union County when we heard that our utility was being left out. The majority of people that I have spoken to want to be included in this bill, not to be left out. And so we're one of the ones that got left out. We are a consumer-owned utility. We just recently had a first phase of power from some of the best wind in the state sold to Idaho Power at 5.5 cents, delivered kilowatt hour, good for 20 years. We in Union County believe that our utility would have been wise to lock in for that rate for 20 years. If you ask our utilities, can they guarantee us a rate of that, you know, that low for 20 years? No one will give us a guarantee. And prices might go up, prices might go down, but we know with that, we know what we've got, and we believe it's an excellent hedge. And so as a member of the OTEC utility, as a co-op member, I am 100% in support of OTEC being included within it. In my part of the state, we often feel like we're part of Idaho. Often legislation, we see the east-west divide. Finally, we have a bill before us that will greatly benefit us. We believe that if this bill is passed, that we can see in Union County the potential of $500 million or more of development in our county. We have lost forest jobs. We have lost family wage jobs. We have lost population. This bill would help to reverse the trend. This last weekend, I was meeting with people who are coming from out of area that were coming to the first phase of our wind project, who are now moving into our area, and we're seeing it changing. The problem is that we need to do more encouragement, and we believe that this bill is passed, we will see much more development in our area. To me, it's like having a farm, a ranch, and having the greatest cattle in the world, but not having a road to take it home, to take it to market. Our forests are locked up. Please don't lock up our wind. That is one of the nicest resources we have. Friends of mine at Eastern Oregon University just returned from a trip from China. In there, they all came back talking about the coal-fired plants that are going online of an average about one every week and how polluted the air was. For me in Oregon, when I think that over 40% of our electricity comes from coal, how can we tell them in China, you need to clean up your act when we can't clean up our own act? And so for me, it's not only a matter of economic development, but it's also, I think, the right thing to do. When I come to this part of the state and I go to a seafood restaurant, I have no desire to eat salmon caught in China. When I build a house in La Grande, Oregon, it frustrates me to see lumber that's been harvested in Canada. And when I use power for my home, I really don't want any of it coming from coal. And so this bill, I think from the other states that have passed it, we have seen some amazing savings, especially those states that have great renewable resources, and that's what we have in Oregon. I'd also like to mention that in my county, that Hot Lake, Oregon, is recognized by the United States Department of Energy as the first place in the United States that used geothermal heat for large-scale use, starting in 1860. So we were a leader in renewable energy in 1860, and I'd like to see us reclaim our position. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Marty Myers. I'm a fifth-generation Oregonian and a member of the Board of Directors of Oregon Business Association and General Manager of Three Mile Canyon Farms. And I appreciate the opportunity today to speak before you in support of this bill. I'm here today to say that this bill deserves support because it naturally embodies all the right values for Oregon. It promotes responsible, sustainable business practices. It provides Oregon farm families with additional revenues with which to build a more stable business model. And it offers the opportunity for a new infusion of investments in Oregon's rural communities. For those of you who don't know much about Three Mile Canyon Farms, we're located about 150 miles east of Portland in the community of Boardman in Morrill County. We own 90,000 acres and we irrigate about 30,000 acres of farmland to grow potatoes, onions, and other feed crops for our dairies. Our dairies are in the center of our property and provide a buffer to our neighbors. Our cows produce milk without any added growth hormones. Our crops and waste from food processing provide an all-vegetation ration for our cows, and the nutrients from the cow manure are applied to certain crop fields to lessen reliance on chemical fertilizers and to realize our goal of 5,000 acres of organic farming in the near future. I say all these things predominantly because I think what this bill represents is an addition to sustainable farming practices. This year, we're developing a community wind project with Momentum Renewable Energy, which will produce a total of 15 megawatts, or enough power to supply power for 5,000 homes. So I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 838 because it provides the certainty and predictability that will be important to the future development of the state's own clean, reliable domestic renewable resources. I'd like to state three reasons why I think that this is important to support this bill. A clear and predictable RES will help Oregonians transition to a safer, more reliable, and affordable energy future. By relying more on the state's own clean domestic renewable resources, we will help decrease Oregon's reliance on imported fossil fuels, an issue of increasing importance today for farmers and rural communities. Two, a clear and predictable RES will bring significant investments, some say billions of dollars, of new economic activity to the state and the region through job creation, property tax payments, and annual lease payments to rural landowners. Important services in Oregon's rural counties will benefit from these additional property taxes. And the RES will grow a new market for current commodity crops and create additional year-round revenue sources for Oregon farmers. That's dear to our hearts. The positive effect of 838 will be stabilizing the enterprises that are often the social and economic backbone of many of Oregon's rural communities. So the impact of the RES goes beyond cleaner air and energy independence. It has a significant dividend of allowing rural communities to maintain their way of life. In conclusion, I urge your passage of Senate Bill 838. In particular, those sections of the bill which refine your focus onto community-sized projects that will enable the development of smaller projects and help communities that otherwise would not attract large-scale renewable energy projects. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen, for coming here today and sharing your comments and thoughts. We really appreciate it. Are there any questions for the panel? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I just want to send a special thank you to you for the kindness you've shown to the members of this panel and the panel before by letting them come up first. I would share with you that Three Mile Canyon Farms is a premier operation, not only in Morrill County, but in the state of Oregon. It's a solid neighbor, and I'll tell you what, Marty, you do a fine job. And I also know I'm in we got a fellow from Eastern Oregon. He shows up to the Energy and Environment Committee in his NRA jacket, lifetime member. And so, Commissioner, it's very good seeing you here.
Thank you. And I have visited Three Mile Farms years ago, and certainly would like to come back and see how you're doing.
We welcome everybody.
Madam Chair, if I may, too, I have a letter that I'd like to submit as testimony from the three commissioners of Union County who are unanimously in support of it.
And you can give that to Ian, and we'd be happy to put that on the record. Thank you again. Okay, next, now we have everyone that has come from far away, and appreciate other folks for their patience. Next, we're going to call up Jason Eisendorfer from Citizens Utility Board and Dave Robertson from PGE. I have to say this is an interesting panel. I have you guys up here together, and there's a chair there in case you need to separate yourself.
Stay on that side.
Jason?
Madam Chair, my name is Dave Robertson. I'm Government Affairs Director for Portland General Electric. I think Jason wanted me to sit on this side because last time I almost gave him a big hug when we were up here. Just so overwhelming.
Really start to worry if we see you guys hugging.
Yeah, there. Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, name's Dave Robertson with Portland General Electric. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. PG supports Senate Bill 838 and urges you to vote it out of committee to the floor. We have been actively involved in discussions around the renewable portfolio standard or renewable energy standard since last year, and we've been part of the governor's renewable energy working group and a number of other groups that have come together to try to hammer out the different pieces of this legislation. Our principles that we developed last year, we really thought we could get behind an RPS, but it had to be meaningful, had to be thoughtful, had to balance the interests of customers, including costs, including reliability and safety, with the need to move forward as we make investments in new technology in our generation portfolio. Our executives up in Portland laid out a list of priorities, including having the Public Utility Commission continue to have authority to implement this, to have a cost cap that was in place, to allow the RPS to integrate with the current planning process, which looks at balancing the costs and risks of different projects that to help meet the energy needs of our customers, to ensure cost recovery of all prudently incurred costs, and also to apply the RPS to all load-serving entities. As we work through the bill and have what is now before you, Senate Bill 838, we really felt that the bill met those priorities and provides us with a lot of flexibility to help meet that new mandate. First of all, the bill allows for some hydropower to count as a renewable energy resource. I know that at times that's controversial on both sides, but we felt it was fairly important and pushed for 50 megawatts of low-impact hydro to be included as a counted as a renewable resource. We've worked pretty hard to get our Pelton Round Butte project certified as a low-impact hydro project. There are a lot of investments that our customers are making there to make it passable for fish and to fix the temperature in the lake back behind the dam to make sure that fish are able to find their way up and downstream. We're actually introducing spawning steelhead above Pelton Round Buttes for the first time since the 1960s. The other things are listed on my testimony there. This does integrate with the PUC's integrated resource planning process. It allows on the cost cap for a comparison of apples to apples costs. What that means is as we count the renewable energy costs that actually count toward the 4% cost cap, it not only includes the cost of the new, for example, wind turbines, but also the transmission and other facilities that are the backup generation and other things that are required to make sure that that power gets to customers 24/7, which is, of course, our charge in life is to keep the lights on. The other things that are really provide us with some flexibility are the alternative compliance payment, and I can explain that more if you wish. Also, one of the ways to comply is to purchase renewable energy credits, which are green tags essentially tied to another renewable project. And if those are anywhere in the western U.S., we're allowed to count those toward our targets for the next 15 or 20 years. So I'll leave it there and leave the rest to questions. But we do feel like the bill provides us with the flexibility, provides us with the tools to meet the 2025 goal that has been set out.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee. I'm Jason Eisendorfer, attorney with the Citizens Utility Board. I don't come down to Salem that often, only when summoned. That means when Jeff calls me and tells me to come down. And I did come down some 6 or 8 weeks ago when the parties who were willing to work with the basic premise of the renewable energy standard sat down to work through the ins and outs and resolve conflicts. And after several weeks of work, the bill that is before you now emerged In the intervening period of time, I went on to do other things, and over the weekend in preparation for today, I reread the bill and I discovered something. What I discovered was that this is a very good bill. It is comprehensive, but it is concise. It establishes a clear path to success, but it contains significant flexibilities to achieve that success. It is good for the environment, it's good for consumers, and it does no harm to the utilities. I sort of like to spend my time today talking about all the positive features of the bill, the movement toward diversifying the utility resource portfolio, the insurance against higher rates that will come as a result of future carbon regulation, the strong ratepayer protections, the path toward a cleaner environment, and even the economic benefits of the bill, many of which you've heard about today already. However, as I come down here, I discover that the few opponents of the bill have created a certain air of misrepresentation and misinformation that I feel that I must respond to. Only a masochist would admit to being an expert on utility regulation law, and so I will only say that I am fairly familiar with it. and I can tell you the following. 838 does not make any significant change to the current PUC rate-making process. The automatic adjustment clause, which seems to be on the lips of a lot of legislators right now, is not a new scary mechanism that allows utilities to rip off customers. 838 does not deprive customers of important hearings in the PUC rate-making process. 838 does not change in any way the used and useful principle established in ORS 757355. And, frankly, anyone who tells you this either does not understand the existing law or the content of the bill or is trying to misrepresent the substance of the bill. The automatic adjustment clause, as I said, is not new. It is in current law under ORS 757210, and it has been there for a while. Utilities could apply for an automatic adjustment clause today if they want. The utilities are currently operating under a number of automatic adjustment clauses, and 838 does not make any significant changes to the rate making. It is also not a giveaway to the utilities. First, the text of 838 actually says that the PUC shall establish a process to develop an automatic adjustment clause or other mechanism. And in that process, all reasonable consumer safeguards will be considered. And second, the existing law already provides safeguards. 838 says that only prudently incurred costs are costs that would be allowed to go through the automatic adjustment clause. And any time you have a prudence situation, you get a hearing on that. With regard to the 4%, the 4% cost cap is neither a guaranteed cost increase nor is it meaningless. Over the long haul, renewable energy may be more expensive, as expensive or less expensive than the alternatives. With regulation of carbon emissions looming in the near future, renewable energy may very well be the economic choice, and we may never even come close to the 4% cap. However, the 4% cap is there as a safeguard for customers. We don't know what the future is, and if renewable energy is consistently more expensive than the alternative, then the 4% cost cap provides a safety valve. It's not too high to be meaningful. Over time, as more renewable resources are added to the rate base, that 4% cap becomes quite meaningful. I would also say that since Dave is in here, PG currently has finished a rate case at the PUC in which Port Westward, a natural gas combined cycle turbine, is going into rates. That's nearly a 3% rate increase. And while CUB worked hard to minimize that as much as we could, we know that any development of future resources is going to come with a cost. That 3% rate increase is comes sort of on a one-time immediate basis. It's not the 4% that is stretched out over 20 years that the 4% cap in 838 represents. So we've worked very hard to make sure that this bill provides the benefits of renewable energy, which we truly believe is a lower cost path than carbon-based resources, which ultimately will come up against future carbon regulation. In the meantime, I think there are a number of ratepayer protections that says on the path to that cleaner, least cost path, that cleaner, least cost future, there are provisions in here to make sure that there are no rate surprises, that the cost doesn't become prohibitive. We feel very good about this bill. We think it is the right policy for the state. And it contains significant benefits for customers of utilities in this state. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Cannon has a question.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Can I ask Mr. Robertson a question? We've heard some concerns about what this might mean for rates. Jason doesn't think that or thinks it's to our advantage. I guess my question is, do we have any, can you provide us any rate guarantees if we continue the current blend of energy sourcing for PGE? Do we have any guarantees if we rely, if we continue to rely predominantly on hydropower and coal?
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, I never provide guarantees. I think one of the things that we've found and learned over the years, and Jason or the folks at Pacific Core could verify, is that whatever we think might happen in the future is almost always wrong after a certain period of time, and we adjust and we keep moving on. Our current mix of generation is about 25% hydropower. This is for Portland General Electric. 25% coal, 25% natural gas, and then 25% market purchases of power. And so as we look at putting resources in our mix, we do an integrated resources plan at the Utility Commission. We look at our growing loads and what we need to meet them. For the next 5 years, the plan that provides the best balance of cost and risk for our customers is an almost exclusively energy efficiency and renewable energy plan. And that's based on the market price of gas, which tends to be our marker point as we compare other resources to that. So as we're looking at whether a cost cap comes into play or not, it just depends. If the cost price of natural gas goes down to $1 a million cubic feet of gas, a renewable energy project is going to be a lot more expensive. But if it continues where it is now, which is in the $8 or $9 range, those renewables are economic compared with alternatives.
As we try to understand sort of why PGE and Pacific Core and other utilities have come along with this proposed requirement, perhaps you can address whether you, as a company, have considered the possibility that in the absence of this bill, state or federal regulation or ballot measure would require your company to do something that might not contain a cost cap. I mean, is that part of your thinking, this sort of anticipation of what could happen, perhaps in ways that are more blunt than this? Now,
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, yes, I think as we looked at whether we should participate in this bill, and we did the same kind of analysis as we looked at, for example, federal climate change legislation, and our thinking was it's better to be involved in trying to shape it and steer it than on the outside trying to battle against some plan that you don't have an opportunity to change. And as we looked at a potential ballot initiative in Oregon, we did pay pretty close attention to what was happening in Washington State last year, where an initiative was put in place that was for 15% renewables by 2015. And the structure of that, and I can't speak a lot to the details of that because all this 838 stuff is starting to mush around in my head with what Washington did. But we looked at that and said, we don't want that. We want to be able to try to make sure this has the flexibility, this has the mechanisms in it that will allow us to meet the targets. But if we're not quite getting there, that we've got some off ramps and some ability to have some relief. So I think that we definitely look at those things, and if we can shape something from inside the tent and make it work, that's great. If we can't, if we're in the tent and it just can't get to where we think it works, we would get out and say it, and we would say so. We would definitely come before you if we thought 838 was going to be a problem for us.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions?
You don't even have to look at me.
I have really good peripheral vision.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much. And Jason, I just caught the tail end of your testimony, written or verbal testimony, where you made a comment, and I'm not going to quote you here, but basically no cost surprises, no surprises, presuming to the rates. But here's the concern I have, and again, we don't have to go into this in great detail here because I'd be happy to have this conversation offline. But for example, under cost limitation section 12, starting on page 8, you know, the whole thing is based on 4% of the utility's annual revenue requirement. Well, the revenue requirements are determined every year by the PUC, so we don't know what this is at this point in time. I can't tell my ratepayers what this is going to do to their rates because we don't know. And furthermore, it says on section 12, subsection 1, starting on line 6 on page 8, it says that the electric utilities are not required to comply, which to me is a lot different than shall not comply. So conceivably, the way this is written, your cost could go up 6-8% of your annual revenue requirement, and yet you could still, for whatever reason, comply with the RPS. So, furthermore, on page 12, where the alternative compliance payments start here, same thing. The PUC shall establish an alternative compliance rate for each compliance year. So again, we don't know what these cost caps are at this point. We just... Help me out here. Am I wrong? Am I reading this wrong?
Chair Dingfelder, Representative Burley, first of all, I would love to come visit you and make you feel as good about this bill as I do.
Or try.
I suppose the bill makes an assumption that rate making continues as it is. Rather than an assumption that this changes rate making significantly, the assumption is that rate making stays pretty much exactly the way it is. The PUC, the staff of the PUC, the interveners in those processes, Citizens Utility Board, the Industrial Customers of Northwest Utilities, largely know what the revenue requirement of the utilities are right now. That is not going to change significantly. So, and on a year-to-year basis, unless there is a significant new resource added to the mix, and even then you know what it is, we are, feel very comfortable that we know what the utilities revenue requirement is going to be. And year-to-year, absent one of those large inputs into the system, a new resource, the revenue requirement is going to stay relatively consistent. There, unless there is a an energy crisis of 2000-2001, there's a fair amount of consistency in that revenue requirement. The alternative compliance payment is in there precisely to make sure if there is some kind of aberration like the energy crisis. And then there's an off-ramp for the utilities that say, look, the market is, has gone haywire. Let us out. And the commission and the parties to that case, which would include us, which include ICNU, we would all agree with that. So your concerns, I think, you know, I don't want to say they're invalid, but I think that they are, the best way to answer it is that it's really a function of the assumption that rate making stays the way it is now.
A couple of quick follow-ups. Thank you. First of all, assuming rate making stays the same, looking at testimony that was on Senate Bill 373, the predecessor to this bill, making some of what I think are some relatively safe assumptions, as you just pointed out, for PGE alone, the 4% of the revenue requirement, if you project it out over 15 years, is $1.6 billion. Now, that's a lot of money to me over 15 years. Now, of course, that's assuming the worst-case scenario, and that is that you're going to spend up to the cost cap. But again, you know, I'm biting testimony to convince me that that's not going to be the case. And lastly, assuming that rate making stays the same raises a question that I suspect would probably best be saved for the PUC witnesses. That is, why then are we interjecting this language about the automatic adjustment clause? If we're going to do rate making the same, why are we doing this?
Chair Dingfelder, Representative Burley, you've raised a couple of issues there. The 4% is still relative. The $1.5 billion is still the 4% of an accumulative $25 billion of revenue requirement over that period of time. My math may be wrong. But running a big electric utility is extraordinarily expensive. As Representative Cannon was alluding to, I think that this bill has a cost cap on the renewables. There is no such cost cap on the gas investment, the coal investment, whatever other investments may come along the pike. And the whole, you know, you go back 100 years, the whole context of utility regulation is based on two premises. One is that investing in generation is extraordinarily expensive. A gas plant is a couple of $100 million. And two, that these investments go exist over a very, very long period of time. A coal plant is a 60-year plant, as is a hydro plant. So when you look at this 4% and you extrapolate it out over time, it is still 4%. And that's what I think is the important thing, and that will translate to a 4% cap, not a guarantee. It's a 4% cap on the rate impact of customers.
I want to address the second part about the automatic adjustment. I think you mentioned it was already in state law when he was out of the...
Yes, Representative Burley. The automatic adjustment clause is not a new... It's not a new concept. It exists in 757.210 now. If there was nothing said about the automatic adjustment clause in 838, a utility could file for an automatic adjustment clause to recover these costs. And, in fact, the utilities... currently are operating under a couple of automatic adjustment clauses in other areas. But this is not a new mechanism. This is a mechanism that currently exists. What 838 specifically does, a specific allusion to the automatic adjustment clause, is that the commission will establish a process over a six-month period of time to look at that automatic adjustment clause, take input from CUB, from ICNU, put whatever safeguards needed to be attached to it from a customer perspective, and at that point you can kick that in. In addition, if the automatic adjustment clause only recovers prudently incurred costs, that's a term of art. That means there's a fact-finding process. That means there's a hearing.
Well, Madam Chair, if I may respond to that.
Okay, and we are about to call up the PUC, so
okay.
I don't know if you want to...
I'm just going to... I want to have this conversation probably with you in detail in the PUC, but, you know, I have to tell you when... And I know that the automatic adjustment clause is already in statute. That's why I'm suspicious. What are we doing here? I'm asking the question, why do we need it here when we already have it? Now, you have touched on some of it already, Jason. I appreciate that, and I'd like to have that in more detail. Now, if I may, while PGE's up here, I've got one question specifically for them. If I'm not mistaken, Section 46, the cost recovery for conservation measures, which is found on page 28 of the bill, was the result of the -10 amendment to Senate Bill 838, which, again, if I'm not mistaken, was offered by PGE. And my interpretation of this is basically without limit, it allows the PUC to authorize an electric company to increase the existing public purpose charge for conservation measures. Is my interpretation of that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, just to give you just a quick bit of background on this, when we look at, I think I mentioned before, as we look at our resource plan and meeting our loads, the things that make that are the least cost resources for us now are energy efficiency and renewable energy for the, at least the next 5 years. What we've asked for, and what we're in you're referring to on page 28 of the bill, is an ability for us to go apply to the utility commission to do more energy efficiency projects to meet that growing load. For the next 5 years, our plan is to do it only for residential and commercial customers. Those are segments under Energy Trust of Oregon that have been underserved, and we believe that there are some additional energy efficiency measures that we can gain there. But that is a resource that, as we look at whether we build a gas plant or whether we build a new wind farm, the one place that we want to try to go to first are more energy efficiency projects. We want to be able to save those kilowatts, and that actually is cheaper than building a new gas plant. So the ability for us to do that, this legislation provides us with the ability to do that. For the next 5 years, it would be approximately 1.3% rate increase, but that still has to go through utility commission review. We'd have to file a tariff. There would be testimony filed, and we would have to show that those projects actually would be beneficial to customers. Does that help at all, Representative?
Okay. Thank you, Dave. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions for this panel? All right. Thank you both.
Thank you very much.
We'll have Lee Beyer and Dr. Lee Sparling from the PUC.
He's that good looking guy.
I don't know. You're not the first time you've done anything wrong in that.
All right, I want you to just drill him with questions. Just pepper him.
Too tough. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Lee Beyer. I'm the chairman of the Oregon Public Utility Commission, and I have with me Dr. Lee Sparling, who is the director of our utilities program, which is basically the regulatory function of the agency. Mr. Chair, members, the Public Utility Commission strongly supports Senate Bill 838. We believe that the governor's standards, proposed standards, make good sense. They're both good economic policies and they're good environmental policies. As you know, the Commission regulates Oregon's three largest utilities. Those utilities collectively serve 75% of all of the customers in the state. And obviously, with our responsibility, we're quite concerned that the standards established and the processes established in 833 do a good job of being implementable. You know, there's nothing worse than getting a bill that you're responsible for that you can't implement. So we work fairly closely with the utilities, the governor's office, and interested parties to get it in the state that we can say today we can implement this bill if the legislature chooses to pass it. So that's basically the start. There have been a number of questions raised since the bill was in this, on the Senate side and elsewhere, five of them of which I'd just like to briefly touch upon, and then we're available to answer any questions you might have. One of the questions is, will the renewable energy targets cause utilities to add unneeded generation? And the answer to that is no, we don't think so. Why? The energy demands of PGE, Pacific, and Idaho Power are such that they were going to add this amount of generation and probably more during the period between now and 2025, whether there's renewable portfolio standards in place or not. What this bill does then is it directs that a majority of that new generation, when it's added, will be renewable sources rather than fossil fuels. Second one was, will the RPS interfere with or replace the PUC's traditional integrated resource planning process? Again, the answer to that is no. For those not familiar with our process, we require under existing our existing procedures that the utilities come forth with a plan that looks ahead 20 years every other year. It's actually, it stretches a little longer than that. It's 2 years from the last time it's projected. Forecasting how much the load growth is going to be and how, what are the options for the utility to meet that growth, and then what we discuss is what's the least cost way to get there. Again, our emphasis on keeping rates as low as we can. The way we look at the standards that are in this bill, there's a requirement that they do a renewable or compliance, if you will, plan and then annual action plans. Our way of thinking of that is that we would, at the very least, coordinate them very closely with the integrated resource plans and probably try to find ways to bring them in together with each other. So I don't think there's a problem with that. Third question is, will the RPS lead to a higher cost? Well, I think you have to start from the position of understanding that if you add generation, you're going to add cost, period. So what you're talking about is, what's the delta between generation that's added that's renewable and something else? One of the things that we particularly like about this bill is the feature that Representative Burley was just addressing to the folks from PGE about the energy efficiency plans that's in that. And quite frankly, the reason is very simple. Our experience in working with this over the last few years through the Energy Trust has been one that we can acquire. We can shave that load, if you will. We can acquire conservation at the equivalent of about 1.5 cents a kilowatt hour levelized. The cost to replace that with new generation is at the very least 4 to 5 cents a kilowatt hour. So it doesn't take a very sophisticated business thought process to say 1.5 is cheaper than 4 to 5. We think, and we know, in fact, from studies that we've had done independently, that there's considerable amount of energy left out there on the table, if you will, cost savings, that would keep us from having to add generation, and it would obviously save customers money. So we like that part of the program. Fourth question is, will the automatic adjustment clause provision in the bill prevent ratepayer advocates from challenging the prudence of any future investment by the utilities? And the answer to that, again, is no. We gave the chair sent us a letter last week that had, I think, about 10 questions on it that sort of danced around this issue, and we did respond to that by Friday, and I hope she provided that to you.
Everybody should have gotten a copy.
It's a rather detailed area. The last panel addresses somewhat, as Mr. Eisdorf said, the automatic adjustment process is already in place in law and has been there for a long time. In fact, if you'll think back to your last session, you actually dealt with it. Senate Bill 408, the tax bill from last session, the mechanism to implement that was an automatic adjustment clause. So it's not new. We currently have it in place on an annual basis with our natural gas companies. We call it a purchase gas adjustment that deals with that, and we've had it on purchase power agreements. So nothing new. I think the thing that may be different here then in those other ones is, to my knowledge, we've never used it before on a capital investment. But in this thing, it would bring it into place. And I think it actually makes some sense if you're asking the utilities to make an investment, a specific investment, and they're saying, okay, if we have to make that to meet law, we want to make sure that we have the opportunity to recover those costs if they are prudently incurred. And I think that makes some sense. The last piece against that is, I think, in terms of having a chance to challenge the prudency, there's been a lot of discussion around that. The way we view this section is, a utility could come in and say, we're going to buy this wind farm, if you will. We're going to do this. And we say, okay, we will recognize that, but you're still going to have to come into an open public hearing process with all of the advocates, as well as our staff, able to ask for specific information. It's called discovery in the legal terms, and argue that case. And in the end, the commission will make a decision about, was that resource that was required to be added on, was that obtained it as cheaply as it could and should have been? That's really the issue. The last piece then is, what is the protection against rapidly escalating rates? And while I don't think there's anything that completely protects against escalating rates, I mean, I would tell you that I came under the commission in 2001 and it sure didn't feel like there was anything that would protect against that. You know, as you well know, saw lights go through the ceiling. There's a lot of things other than these kinds of standards that can do that. But this bill has some protections in it in terms of the 4% revenue cap. I think that is a legitimate cap. And again, what you're looking at there is, what would the difference in rates be between adding a fossil fuel or doing a renewable? That's really what you're looking at. Certainly rates could go up regardless, because natural gas prices go through the roof, our coal prices or rail prices to deliver coal go through the roof. There's a lot of things. Or you have a hydro shortage, as we experienced in 2001, where we've seen the price of electricity on the market go from $30 a megawatt hour to as high as $5,000 a megawatt hour. There's a lot of things you can't protect against. But for the renewable piece, I think there's protection there for that. With that, Madam Chair, you've shifted on me. Madam Chair, I am available for questions.
Okay, thank you, Lee. I apologize. I was out for a bit, not trying to confuse you. I do want to draw attention to the committee members that on the dais there is a copy of the letter that I did send to Ms. Breyer, and I appreciate your quick response on that, and I think that helps clarify a lot of questions I had in my mind. With that, we'll see if there's any additional questions from committee members. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a quick one. Chairman Breyer, it's good seeing you. And let me say, you do a fabulous job for the state of Oregon as our chair of the Public Utility Commission.
Thank you.
Section 22. On line 39, 40, and 41, and give me a moment to turn to that. I apologize. I would have looked this up myself, but the book is missing behind us.
I think it's over here.
Representative Burley, Vice Chair Burley's brought it.
I'll give you the answer if you want.
Okay. Under penalty, it talks about monies paid for penalties under this section shall be transmitted by the commission to the non-governmental entity receiving monies under ORS 757.612 and may be used only for purposes specified in 757.612. Can you share with us who that is and what that is?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lee Sparling. I'm director of the utility program at the Public Utility Commission. In response to your question, Representative Smith, that statutory reference is to the provisions of the public purpose charge that was established under the Electric Restructuring Law in 1999. Okay. Specifically, that's a reference to the Commission's ability to direct a portion of those funds to a non-governmental agency for investment in energy efficiency and renewable resources. At this point, the Commission uses the Energy Trust of Oregon for that purpose, and the uses of the funds are also specified in that statute.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Great. Thank you for that clarification. Good question. Representative Burley. I had a feeling you had a question.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I've got a few for the panel, if I may, and I also want to thank my colleague, Representative Smith, for bringing up that question. That was one of my questions as well. And while we're on the subject of the Oregon Energy Trust, it is my understanding that, and if we need to, perhaps we'll get somebody from the Energy Trust at some point, but my understanding is the Energy Trust right now, as a condition of awarding grants to projects, requires retaining the renewable energy certificates generated from that project. I know that Ferris Lumber and Lyons actually turned down a trust grant because of that reason. And I'm curious why they do that and who gets those credits. Where do they go?
The general standard, Madam Chair, Representative Burley, the general standard is that what the trust, and in fact what the legislation says, is that on the renewable side, that money will be spent to close the gap between the market rate and what it takes to deliver the energy. It's to close that gap. What the trust policy is today, which has been approved by the PUC, is that that amount of the green tags or the energy credits that was bought with the ratepayers' money stays with the trust. That's the issue. The ratepayers are buying those credits, and so they ought to get the benefit of them rather than allowing them to be sold.
Follow up?
Yeah,
did you say that wrong?
Okay. Well, this is where I really get out on thin ice, because I'm not quite sure how the ratepayers benefit from having those credits. Vis-a-vis, the person is putting in this case, the biomass plant, and I go back to last summer when I went to New Hampshire to tour a 50-megawatt biomass plant, which was just going online, and that by an IOU, and also, incidentally, New Hampshire doesn't have an RPS in their state, but that's another story. And he said their payback period was 5 years. And I said, well, how can it be that fast? And he said, because the values of our renewable energy certificates sold in neighboring states, particularly Massachusetts. So I'm sitting here putting myself in the position of this investor, if you will, in this case, Ferris Lumber or Rough and Ready down in Cave Junction or Junction City or wherever it is. That is a huge part of their financial calculation. Wouldn't it be better overall, big picture, if they get to sell those either bundled or unbundled than have them go to the trust? And who knows what happens? I mean, what do they do in the trust? Do they just sit there forever? Do they give them to a utility? Are they used to qualify for the RPS?
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Burley, I think you answered the question, and we've been around this. You and I have talked about this before. In the absence of an RPS, I guess you can argue that what the credits or the RECs, if you will, or green tags, however you want to refer to them, what they're there to do is to have a tracking of how much carbon reduction you're getting out of it. What's the difference there? Usually, and in fact, I think 838 requires that you match the credits up or along to meet the requirements of the RPS. That's how you track it. If you allow the sale of them out of state, you're actually double counting it. That's ending up with, and you can get some money, but you're going to, if you're using the same credits to meet Oregon standards and California standards, for example, and you use the term unbundled, that's essentially what you're saying. Okay, I'm going to get this generation in state, but I'm also going to sell that into another market too and allow them to use those credits against meeting their standard. It gets to be a confusing area. I'm not sure if I'm getting through on this one, but that's the idea, is that that's how you track the reduction, is you don't want to use it more than once. That's the whole purpose.
Okay, follow up?
But that's in the case of an unbundled one, the double counting.
Yeah.
What if it's bundled? What if the power is sold to California?
Well, then the REC would go with it. If you're selling, if Rough and Ready, for example, was selling their biomass generation to California, California would require that they deliver the tags along with it.
Okay.
Thank you for the clarification. Any other questions? I'm sure we'll be hearing again from the PUC.
Yes.
Or visiting.
On yes. The automatic adjustment clause. Here's my concern. Existing statute 757210 says that subparagraph or subsection 1A provided that no hearing need be held if the particular rate change is the result of an automatic adjustment clause. Drop down to sub B, as used in this subsection, automatic adjustment clause means a provision of a rate schedule that provides for rate increases or decreases or both without prior hearing. So, you know, herein is my concern with this thing. In fact, 838 on page 9, line 30, under automatic adjustment clause, simply says the commission shall provide opportunity for public comment. So far, I don't see anything that tells me under an automatic adjustment clause that we've got the same type of hearing, the same type of discovery, the same type of opportunities that provide for the fair, just, and reasonable consumer protection measures, if you will, that we have under the usual rate-setting process.
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, I'm going to let Dr. Sparling answer that, but I will draw your attention to our response to the chairs, where we go into great detail about that.
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, Chairman Barr just mentioned, we tried to address those questions in the response to the letter last Friday. In particular, with respect to the issue of when the hearing is required, as the letter indicates, there are really two stages involved with using one of these automatic adjustment clauses. One is establishing the clause, which in and of itself doesn't cause any rate change. It just puts the mechanism into place. And then there's a second stage in which a utility would come in and ask to actually use the automatic adjustment clause and to request a rate change under it. Now, one of the issues that you might examine, for example, at the first stage, and which some representatives of ICNU suggested to us last week would, in fact, be the case here, is that when there's some cost for a renewable resource, how will those costs be spread between the different customer classes? Will we charge everybody an equal percent increase? Will we charge everybody an equal cents per kilowatt hour increase? That's an issue that would probably be addressed at the point at which we're establishing this automatic adjustment clause. Now, the bottom line here is that once the commission makes that decision about how the clause will work, how it will be established, parties will have full hearing and discovery rights at that point. But once the commission makes that decision, it's not going to revisit them again when the company comes in and asks for a rate increase. So when the company does come in, if we've already decided how we're going to change rates, whether it's going to be equal percent or equal cents per kilowatt hour, that's an issue that's already been decided, would not be subject to hearing again. But any issue that is being raised essentially for the first time, whether it's in establishing the clause or in actually using it to change rates, parties will have their full procedural rights to contested case processes.
Any follow-up questions?
No, thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it. Stick around. Maybe some other questions on Wednesday. We have a couple of folks who I know can't come back on Wednesday because we will have another full day of testimony. So I'd like to call up Dan Haggerty with David Evans and Associates, and also Chris Taylor with Horizon Wind Energy. Is Chris here? And actually, I'll call up at the same time. Is there anybody else who cannot come back on Wednesday? Okay, why don't you come up, please? Make sure you state your name for the record.
Scott Kernan in Texas.
Okay, thanks, Scott. Hey, Chris, why don't you go ahead?
Okay.
Thanks very much. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Chris Taylor, representing Horizon Wind Energy. I was a participant on the Renewable Energy Work Group and sat through quite a few meetings with the Department of Energy and all other stakeholders. We're also the developers of the project that was earlier referenced in Union County, and we've gotten Representative Smith through that process. And we're a large net, without going to a big infomercial, we're a large national developer of wind energy projects. We're currently the third largest owner-operator of wind projects in the world. So we have a fair amount of familiarity with these policies across the country and how they've worked out, and we have an opinion about it. And I guess I would start with, it's frankly somewhat surprising to me that this is a subject of so much discussion, given that more than half the states in this country have already adopted these kind of policies with great success. And if the concerns that some of the opponents have raised were in fact supported by a lot of real evidence, I think we'd be hearing those Grandma Millie stories today. But in fact, we're not, because I don't think those stories really exist. I'm a fifth generation Oregonian. I've lived here most of my life, and I think most Oregonians want to be out in front on issues like this, and this is a great opportunity to do so. And the bill includes a lot of compromises that were put together to address the concerns of different stakeholders, and like all legislation, you may like some of those compromises and you may not. And I think on balance, you've got to look at the whole package, and I think this package addresses a lot of those concerns. I just want to really comment on two things as far as cost and as far as the economic development benefits. As a developer of these wind energy projects, we see firsthand what those benefits are to these communities. And you've got to look at the population base. When you talk about $180 million investment in Union County, if that were in Portland, that would be a $1 billion investment. I mean, these are small communities, and these are very, very large numbers. And the local jobs, the impact on taxes and public services is significant. And one other point I'd like to make is that these projects, unlike a lot of other forms of economic development, don't require anything in the way of public services. So, for instance, the sheriff from Union County, we're not going to be, windmills don't get in fights and go to jail. They don't get pulled over for speeding. They don't require sewage treatment plants. They don't require a lot of public services that other forms of development, which I'm not saying anything bad about those other forms of development, but it's an important thing to keep in mind that we are net contributors to the fiscal health of these communities where we operate. And I think you've seen that with the strong evidence of support. I also have never in my time seen such a diverse array of stakeholders supporting something like this, both East and West, conservative and liberal, rural and urban. It's a rare thing, and I think as legislators, it's a happy thing when you get to see that many different people agreeing on something. That's probably a good sign. And last, I'd really like to turn to cost. I think that's, I'm sorry that Representative Burley just stepped out, because I was really wanting to speak to some of the concerns that he raised. But essentially, I think the point that Representative Cannon asked really speaks to the heart of the matter. What rate protections do we have today? None, zero, zilch. There are no guarantees that our rates won't go up more than 4%. In fact, they have gone up more than 4% in recent years. That's no fault necessarily of the utilities, but I'm a PGE customer. My rates have gone up quite a bit more than 4% over the last several years, and they will continue to go up under the status quo, business as usual. For the consumer-owned utilities, that's been a different story, but I think the world's about to change when the current Bonneville rate case goes away and these utilities are thrown out into the new world of having to acquire resources that where Bonneville can't continue to meet load growth. That's going to be a very different story than we've had historically, and that's not necessarily a warm and friendly picture for a lot of those utilities, and I certainly understand why they're concerned, but those concerns are really separate from whether this bill is adopted or not. Those costs are going to change, and power is going to cost more going forward. A few just real basic points. Almost all of these renewable energy projects are selling their output under long-term fixed-price contracts, and that is something that currently in the utility rate-making world isn't necessarily valued the way the typical private business would value that. In our business, if, say, Vestas wants to offer us fixed turbine pricing for 20 years, we'd buy all we could get. Unfortunately, we can't do that, but fixed pricing is a valuable thing in private enterprise, but with the way cost increases for fossil fuels are passed on in utility rate-making, those risks and rewards aren't fully reflected the way they would be in an unregulated environment. I'm not criticizing that. That's just a fact of how utility rate-making for IOUs is done, and one of the reasons that a bill like this is necessary so that those benefits are fully recognized in the resource procurement process. And I guess the last thing that I'd like to point out is that I think you've heard from a lot of different perspectives that it's very likely that we're going to see some kind of limits on carbon going forward, and the early adopters will be the beneficiaries. If you look at the states where these policies were put into place early, like Texas, Colorado, where studies have been done, they've shown that those policies have already saved significant money for ratepayers, and for Oregon to get moving forward on these things and to lock in some cost-effective renewable resources, be they geothermal, biomass, small hydro, wind, et cetera, right now, while those prices are favorable, I think in the long term will turn out to have been a major cost savings and a major protection for ratepayers. So happy to answer your questions, and thank you for the opportunity to be here today.
Great. Thank you, Chris. Dan.
Honorable Chair, thank you very much, committee members. I'll just make 3 points very quickly. I'm Daniel D. Hegarty. I'm Chief Strategic Officer for David Evans Enterprises. We have four companies operating in this state, five offices just in the engineering, and employ over 450 persons in Oregon. I'm here to support SB 838, strongly support it. I'll give you three reasons. One is the technology investments issue, which Chris just hit on, and some others. There are almost half the states now have RPSs. When I go to clean tech venture capital meetings in other states, frankly, Oregon is chided for not having an RPS. We are behind the curve on that, and if we look at some of the benefits that California has accrued so far, one-third of the venture capital that's been invested in the last few years has gone to California in the clean tech and new energy areas. They now hold the lion's share of the U.S. patents for wind, solar thermal, and solar photovoltaics. We are behind the curve in that regard, and I think my second point leads to this as well. The traditional energy sources, such as coal and gas, are risky business for business in Oregon. And I commend Representative Cannon. I think you were very astute in asking the question, what is the certainty with these traditional fuel sources that we're using today? I would submit that it does not look good in the future. I think the pricing for gas and coal is going to go up substantially, not only because of the world markets, but also the tremendous amount of externalized costs, particularly with coal. It will start being internalized because of the tax, the carbon issue, the carbon footprint, the carbon liability. And it's going to be starting with the insurance companies. Finally, one of the companies we have is called Momentum Renewable Energy. It's a small community wind, community solar business enterprise, 1 megawatt to 20 megawatts. Frankly, we have purchase pricing issues with the utility off-takers and transmission access issues. As you heard from some of the gentlemen from Wasco and Union and Sherman counties, we need more motivation from the public policy standpoint. There's it's a bottleneck right now trying to get into the grid system and to get decent pricing structures. Generally speaking, we're anticipating a major shift in the energy markets and the pricing throughout this country, and I would submit that is Oregon better off leading into the future or following? And I think this bill goes a lot towards moving us towards leadership. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to come speak with you today. My name is Scott Kringen. I serve in a role of a business development manager for Vestas American Wind Technology, and I'm here to speak on in favor of Senate Bill 838. Vestas American Wind Technology is a subsidiary of Denmark-based Vestas Wind Systems, which is the world leader in wind technology and a driving force behind the development of the wind power industry today. To date, Vestas has sold 35% of the accumulated global megawatts of wind turbines installed and has a track record of supplying over 4,000 megawatts here in the U.S. Our North American headquarters are based in Portland, and we have a workforce of over 550 people in North America right now. I want to talk briefly about our company's economic development contributions to the state and region, and also about the importance of Senate Bill 838 in creating possibilities for further investment in renewable energy. Currently, Vestas Americas employs 215 people in Portland. That's including the 30,000-square-foot Portland tool facilities and a brand-new training academy that we're opening up later this year. We're currently planning on two future Oregon service facilities that will employ up to 23 people. These facilities will be based at the wind farms that will utilize our equipment here in the state in the future. We currently have two service facilities in Washington. Our Ellensburg office employs 30 people, and the Dayton office employs 27 people. These are fairly small cities, and so these are substantial numbers and new jobs in those areas that the wind farms are creating. And that's just from the turbine manufacturer side. Vestas currently utilizes the Pacific Northwest as a major port of entry of our equipment. Most of the vessels enter the Pacific Northwest through the Port of Vancouver. To date, over 34 cargo vessels from Europe and the Far East have entered to the Port of Vancouver. And the total cargo moving out of the port, roughly, is if you add it up, around 275 towers, equating to 1,100 truckloads, and the wind turbine equipment itself at 236 at over 1,300 truckloads. As far as the importance of policy, Vestas believes that investment follows policy. If you look at the states out there that now hold renewable energy portfolios, or RESs, you're seeing a great investment from the wind industry, not only from companies like Chris's and the wind farms themselves, but also from manufacturers like ourselves and our competitors investing in those states' manufacturing facilities. Senate Bill 838 establishes a long-term policy that shows Oregon is open for business. It sends a clear signal to companies like ours that we can be confident about investing further in the state. Investors are excited about the economic development contributions we are making in Oregon and believe that Senate Bill 838 would be a strong tool to provide encouragement for further investment.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Any questions for this panel?
Madam Chair, just very quickly, and this is only today crossed my mind, as we move more towards wind for energy, have you done long-term modeling to know that wind will continue to be exist in the state? I mean, I'm thinking climate change, thinking other global changes. We know that wind is going to continue to blow.
I wish I could tell you that we had that one nailed, but to be quite frank, that's something that keeps us up at night. Honestly, I don't think anyone can tell you what the very localized effects are. I mean, I think the climate models will tell you that the winds will probably increase in some places and decrease in others, and whether our wind farms are in the former or the latter category, I can't tell you, but it is something that we worry about.
Can I follow up with that, Madam Chair?
Follow-up question?
Thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I throw this out to any of you three. Once these are fully depreciated out, these wind farms, what's the plans for them once their useful life is no longer profitable?
I'll take a stab at it, and maybe others have something else to offer. In response to your question, Representative Smith, typically the financial models and the financing of these projects assume a 20 or 25-year use life, because that's what the manufacturers are willing to commit to as far as availability of spare parts, et cetera. In practice, the wind farms that were built in California in the 80s are still operating, and those were pretty – think of the computer you had in 1983 and compare it to the computer on your desk today. The comparison with the wind farms from 83 to today are very similar or analogous. So I think our belief is that they will continue to operate far beyond that, and that the likely outcome is that unless we come up with some new other source of power that's even cleaner and cheaper, that we'll be repowering these facilities, either retrofitting, replacing, rebuilding it just like you would the engine on a car, or a hydro turbine at a dam, as they've done recently in some of the dams. Or in the case that they truly stop operating, typically either through Oregon EPSEC if it's over 105 megawatts, or the county if it's a sub-jurisdictional project, there are requirements put in place to fund the decommissioning of those projects at the owner-operator's expense rather than at the expense of the public. And also, at least our leases with landowners provide that same protection on a bilateral contract basis, that we will be responsible for 100% of those costs and that we'll take care of restoring the site.
I appreciate that, Madam Chair. As you know, that was an issue I've raised in previous times, and in my view, I live in the prettiest part of the state of Oregon, and I want to make sure that it stays that way. And I think these are a beautiful addition, but I want to make sure in 25 to 50 years that should these no longer be needed there, that there is a mechanism to have them removed, and I appreciate you building that comfort level in me. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for the panel? Okay, with that, thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 838, and we will reopen the public hearing on Wednesday with more testimony. So apologize if we couldn't fit you in today, but we will be back on Wednesday.